Welcome to a very special edition of Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Jessica Hergert. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. Today, we passed the mic to Jason J. Luke, MD, FACP, and Diwakar Devar, MD, to discuss the clinical trials that have shaped the past, present, and potential future of neoadjuvant versus adjuvant therapy for patients with melanoma. Historically, adjuvant therapy has been a standard of care for patients with melanoma. Despite the benefit in relapse-free survival that adjuvant therapies confer, neoadjuvant therapy has started to pique interest in the field. The belief is that patients may have a more robust immune microenvironment up front and thus may be more responsive to neoadjuvant therapy. However, treatment selection and potential toxicities that could prevent surgical candidacy remain key concerns in this area. In our exclusive interview, Dr. Luke, an associate professor of medicine in the Division of Hematology Oncology and director of the Cancer Immunotherapeutic Center within the Immunology and Immunotherapy Program at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center Hillman Cancer Center, and Dr. Devar, an assistant professor of medicine in the Department of Medicine, Hematology Oncology at the University of Pittsburgh, discuss the evolution of adjuvant therapy in melanoma from interferon alpha to checkpoint inhibition to targeted therapy, the potential advantages of neoadjuvant therapy, and the relative risk-benefit ratio of using these agents in the curative setting.
Yeah, so I'm Jason Luke from the UPMC Hillman Cancer Center in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I'm a melanoma oncologist and interested in immunotherapy drug development.
And I'm Devar. I am also a medical oncologist focused on melanoma and novel immunotherapeutics. And as it turns out, I am also at the University of Pittsburgh in Pennsylvania. So let's take this away, Jason.
Yeah. So we're here to chat today about an ongoing dilemma and an emerging area of research in melanoma therapeutics, and that's around the use of either adjuvant or post-surgical therapy as opposed to consideration around the use of pre-surgical or neoadjuvant therapy. And so I wondered, Dr. Devar, if you want to take a few minutes to tell us a little bit about the history of adjuvant therapy for melanoma, noting that that's been a standard of care for a long time, albeit with some controversy.
That's a great summary, Jason. So as you alluded to, melanoma adjuvant therapy has gone through many iterations, starting with these dark days with biochemotherapy, with CVD, IL-2, IFN. At least up until relatively recent times, the role of interferon alpha, which was pioneered by Dr. Kirkwood and the ECOG cooperative group. And part of the reason you've brought up about the controversy of these data is actually because while the papers actually showed at the point in time in which they were published in the 80s and 90s that interferon alpha was associated with a significant RFS benefit of approximately 25% to 30%, that RFS benefit was attenuated over time, one, and two, the survival benefit was actually minimal. And when subsequently reanalyzed, it appeared that the RFS benefit actually did not appear to exist quite as much as it strongly did. And so there was a long debate for a long time as to, one, whether this agent actually did work as well as it did, and if so, was it actually worth the considerable toxicity that interferon alpha subjected patients to?
And just to maybe jump in for a second, just to kind of hit on that point, it's that I'm getting old these days, and when I was a trainee, honestly, in the late 2000, early 2010, it was actually the fact that the hospital I trained at, which is a very famous one in New York, they did not keep interferon on the formulary because the field was so split about whether or not it was useful that some of the doctors there actually absolutely refused to treat patients with it. So obviously that was not great, but that's actually fortunately not really relevant anymore. You want to tell us about ipilimumab in the adjuvant setting that kind of developed?
And so, you know, really we have to thank Jim Allison for that, because now with the development of IPI in the metastatic setting, very quickly after 2010, people started evaluating it in the high-risk adjuvant setting. And really, you know, there have been several pivotal trials that have done, that have studied IPI in the adjuvant setting. The registrational trials that looked at IPI for a total at the higher dose, and also the registrational trials that have looked at IPI, particularly in comparison to interferon. So I guess the long and short of it is that IPI in the adjuvant setting clearly works. The question is it really worth the toxicity and the deaths, the five deaths that Alex Agamon reported when he stood up at ASCO almost 5 years ago now? And we now have actually a recent data update looking at, you know, the benefit of adjuvant IPI in that setting, and it's clear that it holds true. But again, you know, is the toxicity really worth it? And also, is IPI-10 the right dose for adjuvant IPI in that setting?
Yeah, so absolutely, and I can't agree more. I mean, it's really hard to stomach the idea that you're treating patients in the curative setting with adjuvant therapy that might actually kill them.
Yeah.
So this is a big problem. But again, just sort of doubling back, you know, again, we're fortunate with just how far melanoma therapeutics have come in the last 10 years or 15 years to be able to be, you know, state that both interferon and ipilimumab are no longer standards of care really in the adjuvant setting.
Yeah. And that really brings up, Jason, I mean, we've talked about how these things are now legacy issues, but what do you think about the more modern adjuvant approaches? So we've got, you know, now these new checkpoint inhibitors. We've also got targeted therapy agents for BRAF mutant melanoma. What are your thoughts on the modern approaches for melanoma in the adjuvant setting?
Yeah, so these are really important studies, I think, actually for melanoma, but more broadly across cancer, because they really were some of the first to get at the use of both targeted therapies or kinase-directed therapies and immunotherapies in the adjuvant setting. And melanoma has really been at the tip of the spear of that. And the trials that people should be cognizant of, one is called COMBI-AD, and that was an adjuvant trial of the BRAF and MEK inhibitors, dabrafenib and trametinib, compared with placebos. There were also two PD-1 checkpoint trials, CheckMate 238 and Keynote 54. And it's not so important that everybody remembers the names of them. Obviously, we're melanoma geeks, so we love it. But the really important point is really just how staggering the benefit was. So to go back to the first of those, COMBI-AD, that was dabrafenib and trametinib in the adjuvant setting, again, post-surgical for a year. And the initial readout for that, which was presented a few years back, published in the New England Journal, was a hazard ratio for recurrence at 0.47. When you think about that for a second, that is almost unparalleled in cancer more broadly. I mean, a 50% reduction, more than 53% reduction in the risk of relapse. You know, that kind of blew people's minds, actually. That trial was presented around the same time as the PD-1 trials were first being presented. And, you know, you alluded to the development of ipilimumab in the adjuvant setting. And CheckMate 238 investigated nivolumab as compared with ipilimumab. And just to whittle that study down quickly, the answer was that nivolumab improved relapse-free survival relative to ipi substantially. And was associated with much, much less side effects relative to IPI. And so that's where we come back to this idea that IPI is not a standard of care for adjuvant therapy anymore because nivolumab is so substantially more active. And then the Keynote 54 study looked at pembrolizumab, and the trial designs were slightly different. Pembro was compared to a placebo as opposed to an active control, but ended up showing, again, a very substantial hazard ratio such that essentially all these treatments, so BRAF-MEK or PD-1, are both associated with approximately 50% reduction in the risk of relapse in the stage 3 setting. And so that really has become a standard of care. And we can argue about whether or not we should treat every single stage 3 patient, but I think that's outside of the scope here. The only final caveat I wanted to make was people are obviously aware of, you know, doublet checkpoint blockade with nivolumab and ipilimumab. And very interestingly, actually, the first adjuvant trial to read out, CheckMate 915, actually has not so far shown a benefit to ipi-nivo in the adjuvant setting, although we're waiting for the full data set and an actual disclosure of the specific results. So those are all sort of really benchmark things that the oncology community has to be aware of. They go across disease types to show that these sorts of approaches can be effective in the adjuvant setting. So we wanted to set that background, but really also introduce the concept of neoadjuvant therapy as well. And I wondered, Dr. DeVore, if you want to take the reins on that, talk about where do things stand with neoadjuvant in terms of why would we even think that might be a preferable way to go forward in terms of treating patients if we can, otherwise we could just treat them in the adjuvant setting.
Thanks for that introduction and really that excellent framing of the discussion. And really, you know, when we start thinking of a neoadjuvant therapy in melanoma, what is almost embarrassing is that we have come to it so late. You know, if you think about it, with breast cancer, breast cancer has pioneered the idea of neoadjuvant therapy. Drugs have actually been approved in breast cancer based on neoadjuvant endpoints, and whether that's because, you know, it is a disease in which people can coalesce around the idea of that particular endpoint as being better for drug approval, or whether people could just work together and had relatively fewer drugs that one needed to worry about, we don't yet know. But there are several particularly unique things about the neoadjuvant landscape in melanoma, at least, that are particularly important, particularly in relation to the agents that you and I so clearly love, which are the immunological agents. And so Shireen Loy and Mark Smith over in Australia have two really seminal papers looking at this and really sort of teasing out the idea in a surgical model as to whether neoadjuvant therapy, that is pre-operative therapy, is better than post-operative therapy, that is adjuvant therapy, in the context of a implantable tumor model. And what is, you know, the high level of these two papers, one in Cancer Discovery and one in Oncoimmunology in 2016 and 19 respectively, are that in the setting of perioperative therapy, when treatment is administered before surgery, there is a greater magnitude to the immune therapy that is seen in terms of cancer eradication and also in terms of the generation of the immune response. So the idea, I guess, is that if one is trying to train the immune system, much like you're trying to train a dog how to recognize what is foreign, it turns out that showing the immune system a little bit of what it needs to recognize may actually be a little better than trying to expect the immune system to recognize what has already been eliminated.
Yeah.
There are other theoretical benefits, the elimination of micrometastases, the acquisition of tissue for translational purposes, and also potentially, you know, the evaluation of new therapies a little earlier. But there are some real compelling arguments as to why neoadjuvant therapy might actually be better, if we can all agree on what to give.
Yeah, but I mean, aren't there kind of straightforward clinical concerns, though? I mean, in terms of, obviously, if we're trying to treat people with systemic therapy before surgery, can't it be the case that either they progress or they might actually have toxicity such that they aren't able to actually get treatment?
I'm very glad that you brought that up, because that is something that, as a community, we should really argue. So one of the interesting parallels, I guess, between breast cancer and melanoma, well, I wish it were actually a better parallel, is that while the breast cancer community very early agreed upon both the importance of neoadjuvant trials, it very quickly agreed that how to go about doing these neoadjuvant trials. In melanoma, we've actually been doing neoadjuvant trials for a long time without ever agreeing on how they should be structured. And so when you look at, for example, what has happened in some of these studies, you know, done at very, very prestigious centers, some things that have happened that have that you've alluded to. So for example, with single agent checkpoint, when you treat patients for 12 weeks, 2 out of 11 patients that were treated at MD Anderson actually could not undergo surgery. So these patients didn't respond, that much is clear, but they lost the ability to undergo potentially curative resection. When the T-VEC trial was done, comparing neoadjuvant T-VEC to what is unusually standard of care, and some would argue about that as a comparator arm in Europe, the number of patients who actually progressed on single agent Lehepovec was actually quite considerable, suggesting that when you give somebody a neoadjuvant, an immunological agent perioperatively, the loss of surgical potential is definitely something of concern. And that can be potentially limited by the duration and the careful monitoring of these patients in these studies.
So if that's the case, then why are we so excited about it? What are the data from new adjuvant trials that really kind of make us think that this might be worth it?
Really, there's this idea that we all have seen, you know, whether it is from IL-2 or whether it is from checkpoint inhibitor, that curative patient, that patient who has been rendered disease-free with advanced cancer. And what is so clearly abundant with neoadjuvant therapy is that you can identify those patients actually relatively early. So the remarkable data set comes from a couple of patients, a couple of studies, but well summarized by our Australian colleagues at ASCO last year, in which at a presentation done in which all the neoadjuvant studies were pooled and looked at by Alex Menzies, the patients who had a pathologic complete response, albeit with a median follow-up of only 10 months and albeit only in 51 patients who received, again, you know, a whole host of different treatments for different durations, including single agent checkpoint and dual agent checkpoint and studies that came from Europe and Australia and the United States. The key point being that the patients who had a pathologic complete response had a staggering 100% RFS benefit, suggesting that these patients, again, with the limit caveat of a limited follow-up time, these patients might truly be cured, and we might, more importantly, know who these patients are at the time of surgery.
Yeah, so, I mean, those data really are pretty impressive when you think about it, in terms of basically nobody who had a complete response prior to surgery has recurred. And I think that that is really interesting, but I still am a little unclear about this field, because when you look at that data, those were patients who got Ipi and Nevo together. And we talked a little bit now about how the adjuvant trial showed that we didn't really get a benefit there. And it's not clear exactly how you would design a clinical trial for, you know, this population of patients, because it certainly seems like PD-1 monotherapy actually doesn't work well enough to be useful as an adjuvant therapy. So it's, I think I wanted to point out that there is an ongoing neoadjuvant clinical trial through the cooperative groups. It's called the SWOG-S1801 study. And certainly we always recommend patients participate, but I don't know, what do you think about that? Because that's evaluating single agent pembrolizumab, and the data that you just mentioned was all data for Ipi and Nevo together.
Well, Alex did include the study from Huang et al., which is basically Dr. Mitchell's study from the University of Pennsylvania, you know, 29 patients treated with single agent pembrolizumab for just one dose, in whom the pathologic complete response rate was 19%. So, you know, one out of five patients having a PCR. So he did, you know, admittedly include at least one Dr. Amaria's study from MD Anderson, at least the control arm on one study was single agent Nevo. So the, yes, they did have neoadjuvant PD-1 monotherapy, but I do agree that the issue with SWOG-1801, as I see it, is the duration of therapy. So is Ipi, is single agent PD-1 pembrolizumab a good control arm? We don't know. Is single agent pembrolizumab given for 9 weeks a good idea, especially given that we know from the MD Anderson data that 2 out of 11 patients progressed in that span of time? That is definitely something that I am concerned about. And we are committed to supporting these trials. But one of the things that is going to emerge very quickly on that SWOG-1801 is going to help us answer, assuming that is it's completed, is the duration of therapy in neoadjuvant landscape important? And how little do we need in order to see a benefit? So you brought up a great point. You know, is PD-1 monotherapy a good control arm? We don't know. Is there one that's better? We don't know.
One of the things, though, I think that you mentioned earlier, I think is of interest to talk about is, obviously, we know about Ipi-Nevo and we know about PD-1. What about novel combinations? There's a lot of new drugs being developed. Have there been any interesting trials that you might have been involved in?
So thank you for that lead-in to talk about my own work and toot my own horn, though I'd really hate to do that. But thanks for the invitation nonetheless. But the point is, yes, I think one of the most interesting things about the new adjuvant space is that it gives us the opportunity to try new drugs. So this is a drug that, you know, it's not exactly a drug that you've never heard of, because I think you were also involved in the development of this agent, which is a TLR9 agonist, a type A CPG oligodinucleotide from a company known as Checkmate Biopharmaceuticals, which very interestingly enough is headed by a gentleman by the name of Art Krieg, who besides having a love for long distance running and torturing himself through arduous mountain exercises, was also the guy who actually first discovered TLRs back when he was at the University of Iowa, which actually is a place that you went to. So anyway, TLR9, very interesting drug, very interesting data. You have been involved with Tom Gajewski, who's published some of the early work on this. And we at the University of Pittsburgh thought, you know what, why not? Let's try it in a neoadjuvant trial. So we utilized the exact same neoadjuvant in the neoadjuvant setting, the schedule that you guys had utilized in the advanced disease study, which we were also fortunate to be a part of. And so patients are getting patients with high-risk resectable melanoma, that is patients with stage 3 B, C, or D melanoma, are getting neoadjuvant TLR9 CPG for a total of 7 weeks, along with nivolumab given for a total of 7 weeks. So 3 doses of nivolumab, 7 doses of CPG. And we've reported this data last year at SITC and are getting ready to publish it. But the highlights are as follows. One, nobody failed to hit surgery. So everybody was able to get to surgery. Nobody missed on surgery because of rapid early progression, which is something we're very cognizant of, because as you've alluded to earlier, we don't want to miss the window of curing a patient from a surgical resection. But very interestingly, we also reported a very, very high PATH CR rate. So the PATH CR rate in our study is 60%, and the major pathologic response rate, that is a percentage of patients with a complete pathologic response, as well as the patients with major pathologic response, that is the residual volume of active tumor of less than 10%, collectively was 71%. So in a small cohort of 21 patients that has now been expanded to 30, 71% of patients had either no viable cancer left or minimal viable cancer left. And those patients actually have prolonged RFS, and none of the patients who had a PCR have actually had relapsed at this time. So we're very excited about that data.
Yeah, and I think Dori's pointing out that we've been exploring intratumoral immunotherapies now in the advanced disease setting in a lot of clinical trials. And we sometimes employ this idea of sort of an abscopal effect or so on and so forth, and this kind of thing where you get a distant immunological effect from where you inject. But I actually think that, you know, the use of agents like this immune agonist, a TLR9, might be optimal in a setting where you're trying to treat the tumor that's right there, right, to really amplify the immune effect right in front of you.
Yeah, absolutely, Jason. I mean, you've led a lot of the studies to do with intratumoral therapies, particularly with STING, right? And, you know, when you think about where these agents are likely to go, some of the best data that we've gotten, we truly believe that STING agonists are actually functional, and there are certain very nice STING agonists that are currently in development. But especially for intratumoral therapies, this might actually be the best area for them, particularly because one thinks about the heterogeneity of tumors and one thinks about how much the innate system can do. It may be best that an innate agonist is employed in a low tumor burden setting in such a study. Also, as we've shown, and other people have shown, that when you give the agent in the setting, you're elaborating circulating tumor antigen-specific CD8 T cells. We've got some nice data on this. And as Jane Grogan has shown recently, these tumor antigen-specific CD8 T cells that have a immunophenotype of Ki-67 high and PD-1 CTLA-4 double positive are actually the antigens, antigen-specific T cells that are essentially representing the bulk of the tumor-specific antigen cells that are expanded by the checkpoint inhibitor.
So, I mean, thinking about this then, I mean, I think these are really exciting data. I just still wonder a little bit about how to put this in the context of our overall treatment paradigm, because I guess we should note there was one other study of Ipi and Nivo that's worth highlighting. There was a study out of Germany reported last year for patients who actually had stage 4 melanoma that was resected and were treated with Ipi and Nivo. And the results there are really kind of unbelievably outstanding, because whereas I told you that other adjuvant trial was negative, here now we see that like 70% of patients have not had recurrence in a year of treatment. And I think it's worth noting, this is just an area that's just really wide open. We look at across the field more broadly, there's a number of other agents for melanoma that are also being developed, like the LAG-3 antibody relatlimab, as well as the IL-2, modified IL-2 agonist Bempeg, all this leukine. And, you know, there will probably be adjuvant trials of these as well. And it's becoming a little bit hard to know how would we compare back and forth between all these things.
Yeah, so that's, you brought up a very interesting point. So I guess one of the things that we kind of need to agree upon as a field, I guess, is firstly, you know, what is the ultimate landscape for neoadjuvant therapy? Something that the breast cancer guys were agreeable to do almost 15 years ago now. But should this be limited to stage 3 B, C, and D patients, or should we potentially include patients with stage 4 resective disease? And, yeah, you know, the ImmunoMed data, certainly speaks to that setting. But let me ask you something else. I mean, we've talked a lot about the role of neoadjuvant therapy for stage 3 B and C disease. But what about what we are learning about potentially curing some of these patients even before they relapse, particularly because we know that some of these patients are actually going to relapse in the node early on because of the MSLT2 data, which resulted in some of the nodal dissections being deferred. But what about trying to treat patients even earlier, such as in the stage 2 high-risk resected settings that are node negative?
Yeah, so this is an idiosyncrasy of our melanoma staging system, the AJCC, where we observe that patients with stage 2 melanoma who have deeper primary lesions are actually at higher risk for relapse and death than the patients who have a single lymph node involved. And that kind of runs counter to how we usually think about our staging system. So, for example, what I'm saying is that stage 2 B and C melanoma is actually higher risk than stage 3 A. If you think about all the things we've talked about at this point, we have an on-label approval to use BRAF and MEK inhibitors as well as PD-1 antibodies for stage 3, but we don't for stage 2. And as you alluded to, there are two registration trials in adjuvant stage 2 disease that are ongoing. One is the CheckMate 716 trial looking at pembrolizumab. And there's another study, Keynote 716 and CheckMate 76K for nivolumab. So it looks pretty likely that we'll end up using adjuvant therapy in stage 2, and I think raises the possibility that we'll be extending these therapies and maybe possibly even eliminating the utility of some more aggressive surgical approaches even further moving into the future. I think this raises, you know, this question about like, so how are we then going to think about this? Because one could imagine, and I don't know if you've, you know, brainstormed on this yet at all either, you could take a neoadjuvant approach even pre-surgical for stage two disease with just a deep primary. And I think some people are actually even starting to think about that in our field.
Yeah, so an investigator at the University of Pennsylvania is doing exactly that, giving a single agent of a checkpoint pre-surgically at the time of stage two high-risk T4B primaries, T4C, T4A and T4B primaries to try and see what the likelihood of nodal positivity is going to be. You know, we think that hopefully these stage two studies are indeed positive and can offer at least some of our patients the opportunity to get a checkpoint inhibitor therapy even earlier on in their life cycle to try and magnify the benefit of these drugs for even more patients. And I guess, you know, what this sort of all really comes to mind is that we are, I guess, very fortunate in melanoma that we have these exciting drugs after a very, very long period of time in the dark ages when we had drugs such as interferon alpha and CBD and biochemotherapy where we needed to worry about the toxicity profiles. We've got new drugs that are clearly efficacious and are profoundly beneficial for patients, but really we need to try and think about how best to use them. So I guess along those lines, what do you think are the next steps for neoadjuvant disease and where do we think we need to go with that? And what do you think we should be doing in neoadjuvant disease at this time?
Well, you know, so I still remain kind of committed to adjuvant therapy. And I think the big unmet need in neoadjuvant is to really do that big prospective trial that really documents the overall benefit to it. And so I think that there's probably two ways to do that. People will remember that the original approvals for neoadjuvant approaches in breast cancer, they weren't actually from a trial per se. They were the aggregate data from a bunch of trials. So I think, as you alluded to, one of the things that needs to happen in neoadjuvant is there really needs to be harmonization of the way these trials are done so that we can take forward data sets to really show there's a benefit. And certainly there's a group of investigators, the International Neoadjuvant Working Group, that are trying to do that. But then we need more efforts like that SWOG trial that we mentioned, which is actually trying to truly show there's going to be a benefit. And then, you know, more broadly than that, I think we need to continue to explore kind of some of these novel agents, because I think kind of your data really suggests that something like the TLR9 agonist really has the potential to be a, you know, a game changer. I don't want to over exaggerate, but if we could get up to 60 and 70% pathologic response, you know, we really feel strongly that those patients are going to do well over a long period of time. Summarize it by saying that I think we have a lot to do, and I think that this really just emphasizes that you know, it's great that we've advanced systemic therapeutics for metastatic disease and melanoma, and the opportunity space really exists here now to think about curing more people with these systemic therapies, and it's not pie in the sky. Whether it's adjuvant therapy, neoadjuvant therapy, I think we really are there, and we really need to prioritize getting patients on these trials, because this is a big deal. We're talking about curing patients, not just managing them in a metastatic setting.
Completely agree. And I would add one thing to that, and that is you brought up the idea. And really what you're referencing is that meta-analysis in the breast cancer setting in 2008, the Montezuma meta-analysis, in which they showed 12,000 patients were aggregated. And really, the idea, the link there was between PCR and long-term survival. So linking a early endpoint.
Pathologic complete response.
Pathologic complete response to what is a registrational endpoint, in this case, OS and PFS, and showing that those two things were linked. And you're right, we in the melanoma space are still yet to do that, and hopefully with some of our colleagues, you and I are both members of the neoadjuvant consortium. We can try and get this stuff done. But I do agree with you that really adjuvant therapy is really an area that we need to focus on. But it comes down to the idea of what next in the adjuvant space. And really one of the best things about the neoadjuvant setting is that we are identifying very early on what is additive. And as you've said, you know, the TLR9 data is interesting. But as you and I have both been involved with the TLR9 data in the metastatic setting, it took a long time for us to even know if it's adding anything. But with a small 30-patient trial, we have a nice signal of response. And so that one of the benefits of the neoadjuvant space is that by prioritizing drugs to be evaluated in that setting, we get a sense as to just how much they're going to work. Now, it's not perfect. Mm-hmm. It will need to be further benchmarked and tested and rigorously tested. But one of the cool things that we take away from the neoadjuvant setting is, one, what works, what doesn't, and if it doesn't, we should really get rid of it as quickly as possible. And two, if it's working and we have a biomarker that's showing that it's working, well, then we know what next to prioritize in the adjuvant setting. So I agree. This is a very exciting time for our patients. We have many options, but we also need to work together to try and advance the next wave of drugs that are coming beyond the PD-1, the CTLA-4 agents, into the neoadjuvant and the adjuvant settings.
Yep. So that's great. I'd like to say thanks for joining me today to chat through these things. I think, again, just the highlight is that we have so many treatments for our patients now that we got to learn better how to use them. But we'd really ask, so anybody listening, please consider participating, have your patients participate in these trials, because it's a really exciting time where, again, it's not pie in the sky to say that we're curing more patients. And when we think about it, that's just a really amazing thing to say about melanoma, you know, 10 years from the development of immune checkpoint blockade. So thank you very much. I really appreciate you joining, and pass it back to the host.
Thank you for the invitation.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to Onc Live On Air. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for recaps from our State of the Science summits and exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and OncLiveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.